BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Musician and writer Ben Watt released his first single when he was just 19. In 1981, on his first day as a student at Hull University, he met Tracy Thorne, and together they formed the duo Everything But the Girl, taking their name from the slogan of a local furniture shop. Over the next 20 years, they had 12 top 40 singles and 7 top 20 albums. Since then, Ben's musical curiosity has encompassed dance and electronic music, running his own record label, and a return to songwriting with the release of 3 solo albums. Ben has also written 2 acclaimed books, the first about his experience of a life-threatening autoimmune disease, and the second, a poignant portrait of his parents. Most recently, he's returned to making music with Tracy Thorne, now his wife, with the new Everything But the Girl album. So what music are you going to introduce us to first, Ben?
Well, I found that during lockdown, I got into making playlists. And one of the things I put together was a playlist that I called Night Piano. I stumbled across this piece by William Grant Still. He was, of course, the kind of godfather of African-American composers, part of the Harlem Renaissance. I think the first black composer to be performed by a major symphony orchestra. And anyway, this piece of his, Summerland, is part of a longer piece encompassing 3 parts. And I just found it seemed to capture a lot of what I really liked in music, which is a kind of classicism mixed with a kind of folk mentality. And the music I find is quite sort of hymnal and spiritual, but also quite romantic, meditative, and lots of flourishes of kind of blues and folk phrasings.
It has a lazy summer feel to it, doesn't it?
I love it. It seems to foreshadow the whole kind of great American songbook.
30s and 50s was his heyday, wasn't it?
Yes, so I think this is from the mid-30s. He's not that well known, even though he wrote 200 works, 5 symphonies, 4 ballets, yeah. You know, 9 operas.
Bruce Levingston was playing Summerland, the second of William Grant Still's 3 visions. Do you like the improvisatory nature of it, too? You feel as though the pianist could almost just be making it up on the spot?
Well, improvisation is something that I'm very drawn to. I mean, my father was a jazz musician, and from a very early age, he would take me to the local jazz pub in southwest London where we grew up in Barnes. And I got very used to standing on the fire escape at the jazz room entrance on Sunday lunchtimes, listening to quartets and trios.
I've been reading your book, Romany and Tom, which is a very moving portrait of your parents.
Thank you.
Your mum seems to be the most glamorous kind of journalist.
Yes, well, she had to reinvent her career midway through her life. She'd been an actress at Stratford with what became the RSC. But then she had triplets in her first marriage and really had to give up her acting career. And when I remember her, she was working largely as a kind of showbiz feature writer and made her name with some exclusives, interviewing Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, and would fly to all these glamorous places like Acapulco and Rome and come back with trinkets and presents for the family.
How did she meet your dad then?
Well, that was, you know, slightly more dramatic. I mean, midway through her first marriage, I think she realised that emotionally she was quite unhappy. Their relationship was not particularly sexual, and it was something that my mother really missed. And she ran into my father at a party that was hosted by a mutual friend. And they started quite a torrid affair for 3 years in the late 50s and ended up both divorcing from their first partners and marrying in the early 60s.
So they had to keep it quiet for a while, that relationship.
Well, you know, in those days, getting a divorce was not easy. It wasn't just something that could be done at the drop of a hat. Yes. You had to live for 3 years.
Almost. Then you used to have to hire men to come and be photographed going in and out at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, you had to prove it, basically, yeah.
Well, I was glad you mentioned the jazz influence in the last music, because it is one of the jazz greats that we're going to hear next, great guitarist. Why this?
So, obviously, my father played jazz to me from a very early age. I learned piano when I was very young and then played the flute for a while at school, but then, of course, came to the guitar like a lot of teenagers do. And when I did, my dad insisted that I listen to Wes Montgomery. He said that he really was the cornerstone of all great jazz voicings on the guitar. And what's interesting about Wes Montgomery is that there are only two recordings of him playing solo in his entire career. And one of them appears on this rather insignificant album that was put out by Riverside in the early 60s called Guitar on the Go, which is like a very old-fashioned jazz title.
It's a very 60s title.
It is, yeah. But anyway, there's this very beautiful recording on it called Mi Cosa, and it just seems to capture so much of what was quite revolutionary about his playing, where the voicings would move with the lead line on top, up and down the fretboard, playing with a thumb, not the pick.
Quite like a classical guitarist.
Really, yes. And I mean, his single line note choices are always so beautiful, I think.
Cosa, a track from the Wes Montgomery Trio's 1966 album, Guitar on the Go. It's nice to be able to extract a player, isn't it, Ben, from a group, and you often want to hear more of the personal style of a guitarist.
Definitely. I mean, with guitarists that my dad turned me on to when I was young, I was always drawn to the solo virtuoso players. Joe Pass was another. The solo voice has always been a big thing for me. The idea of somebody expressing themselves alone.
Tell us about your dad's playing. What did it sound like?
Well, his great thing was the big band. And in the late 50s, he managed to put together, with the help of a couple of people, a jazz orchestra. He also had a quintet at Quaglino's, which was one of the places to play in London. He worked at the BBC, recorded for Parlophone, with George Martin as his producer.
In fact, George wanted him to help with the Beatles at one point.
Well, yes, that's another story. I mean, I think as the jazz ensemble and jazz in general was being elbowed out of the way by rock and roll, George came to my dad and said, look, I've discovered these four lads from Liverpool. They need an arranger. Are you interested? And my dad took a listen and said, look, I'm sorry, but this isn't for me. And, well, you know, we may laugh, but he never really regretted it. I mean, there were plenty of his contemporaries who did go into pop arranging, but it was something that he just said his heart was never in.
Your mum was often away, so Tom was a kind of house husband, wasn't
he? Was,
he
was, really? Yes.
Looking after your stepbrothers, your sister and you. What was that like?
It was an interesting time. I mean, I think looking back, although I probably didn't realise it when I was young, my dad was basically getting increasingly depressed. And rather than listening to the swinging big bands that he did when he was young, the music that was played in the house was much more contemplative. Mm. Pianists like Bill Evans, saxophonists like Stan Getz, and Toot Seelman, Belgian harmonica player, became a huge favourite of my dad's. And of course, I look back now and I realise that was really sort of capturing the mood that he was in inside.
He was a fan of this next music, wasn't he?
There was a local jazz shop in Richmond. I used to love going there with him, and it was called Potter's Music Shop. And Jerry Potter would always recommend albums to my dad, modern as well as old reissues. And my dad came home one day with this, which was the Quincy Jones Smackwater Jack album, I think from 1971. And in the middle of it is this piece written by Ray Brown, the bass player, called Brown Ballad. And it does have Toots Tillman playing the main lead line on it, you know, the chromatic harmonica. And I read recently, Quincy Jones now looks back on it as one of his favourite ever things that he recorded.
It pulls at the heartstrings.
Absolutely, yes.
Certain indulgence in the new electronic instruments of the day.
Well, I mean, how could you resist them, you know?
We heard Brown Ballad, Quincy Jones, from his 1971 album Smackwater Jack. So, Ben Watt, your father's career seems to have ended rather in disappointment, but that didn't put you off as a teenager from pursuing music.
No, I was very much part of that generation in the late 70s, early 80s that was influenced by punk, for want of a better word, the kind of do-it-yourself spirit of punk, as was Tracy in her own way, although we hadn't met at this point.
No, because in 1981 you went to study drama and English literature at Hull University, didn't you? And I think you made an entrance that day with your dad.
Yes, he insisted on driving me up, and we went across the Humber Bridge, smoking something in the car on the way in. And
surely not.
Yes, as a sort of celebration, I think, in some ways. And we arrived at my student house, and my dad just sort of marched in, this charismatic way he had, put his feet up on the couch, insisted the kettle was put on, got a couple of the students who'd already arrived to unload my trunk for me from the car, and just regaled them all with stories for about half an hour, and then just basically got back in the car and drove all the way back to London.
It is interesting, isn't it, how people like your dad, who are quite depressed, can actually perform once they've got an audience. They can turn people on.
Yes. The one word my mother always used about my dad was that he always yearned for stimulation. And that was company, basically, which is often why it led him to the pub.
Now, do tell me, there wasn't a certain librarian working at the university at that time, was there?
There was, Philip Larkin. I mean, Hull, I found it a real magnet, and my school was quite sceptical about my going there, but I'd done my research, and my interview in the drama department was with Anthony Minghella, who was teaching there at the time. Andrew Motion, who went on to become Poet Laureate, was in the English department. Hull had one of the only working studio theatres in any university in the country. And you're right, in the library was Philip Larkin, which just seemed to be the icing on the cake in many ways. So I loved Hull. I loved being there. I thought it was a really smart, inventive, but very down-to-earth kind of place to study.
And it was at Hull that you met Tracy?
Yes.
On the very first day, what happened?
Well, we knew we were both going to be there. We'd both been signed as teenage songwriters and singers to a small label in London called Cherry Red. So me being me, I thought, well, let's just meet up. And on the first day, I went over to the Union Building and I asked if the porter could put a message out over the tannoy, because I basically most of the freshers were in the building that night because it was the first night at university. And he said, if Tracy Thorne of the Marine Girls, which was Tracy's first band, is in the building, could she please come up to reception now? And I waited, and 5 minutes later, she came up the stairs, and that's how we met.
What a lovely story. You formed the band together, had great success, 8 gold, 2 platinum albums, touring the world. Did you find that that cemented your relationship, or did it make it more complicated? Because often success can be difficult to deal with.
I think at the beginning we were very bonded over it. You know, things just rolled on from one record to the other. What changed was when we had kids and it became a lot more complicated. Tracy found the pressures of being both a mother and a performer just too much. And she turned to me and said, look, something's got to give and I'm afraid it's got to be the music. Mm. And then I think we fell into a pattern of working separately for a while. And I moved more into electronica, started DJing, remixing other artists.
Now, I think you were watching a programme about that wonderful French musician, teacher, taught my father, in fact, Nadia Boulanger.
Yes.
It was there that you found our next singer.
Yes. Somebody turned me on to this documentary about Nadia Boulanger, who I didn't know anything about. As you say, she was a famous music teacher and conductor.
I think people like Copland and Bernstein all went through her hands.
Even Quincy Jones, who we just heard.
And Stravinsky's son, Sulima, who's in my father's
Daniel Barenboim, Philip Glass. You know, it was an amazing parade of people who passed largely through her salon, her family flat in Paris. What really drew me to her was the way she spoke about music, which really struck a chord with me. Her absolute insistence that you can't teach anybody anything. You just have to kind of encourage their drive and curiosity. You have to teach people to learn to listen as much to the silence in music as you do to the notes that you're choosing. She said, never strain to avoid the obvious, which I think is a really great thing to live by. Finding the melody that really speaks to you. All these things that I thought, this is me she's talking to. And in the midst of this documentary, she's with a group of students in her flat and she plays them this Brahms piece sung by Kathleen Ferrier. And I was extremely moved by it, especially after all the things she'd said. The complete simplicity of the melody, a melancholy edge which always catches my heart. I just found myself entranced by it.
Saphische Oder, the fourth of Brahms's 5 songs, opus 94. The contralto, Kathleen Ferrier, with the pianist Phyllis Spur, recorded in 1949. And it really is a contralto sound, isn't it?
Yes.
You often don't hear that so much now. Everybody wants to be a mezzo so they can do more roles. But that sort of deep in the chest sound is very beautiful.
Well, I sometimes wonder whether I'm drawn to it because of Tracy, who has a very deep-sounding voice for a female singer.
Fascinating. After years in the spotlight, Ben Watt, in 1992, you were diagnosed with a very rare but life-threatening autoimmune disease. How did that change your life?
Well, it changed it in many ways. It was an incredibly traumatic experience, both physically and psychologically. I got exceptional care while I was in hospital. But then both myself and Tracy, we were expected to fend for ourselves. And of course, I lost a lot of my small intestine to surgery. And I came out to a brand new life where I'd lost a huge amount of weight. My diet was completely altered. I was a lot more fragile. And it took many years to really come to terms with it, I look back on. Tracy says to me, there were some things in me that weren't changed at all and that I still kept the same sort of drive and urgency to work. I was a bit like the knight in Monty Python and the Holy Grail who has his arms cut off and says, it's just a flesh wound, you know.
Yes, you wrote about your experiences in another fine book, Patient, The True Story of a Rare Illness. How different was the creative process? I mean, how did you channel that drive? Did it make any difference in the way that you wrote songs?
I mean, Tracy had been the dominant lyricist. And I think after my illness, I developed a lyric writing voice that I hadn't had before. It first manifested itself in the book, which then led to us recording one of our most successful records, Amplified Heart, in 1994, which has our biggest hit.
So there was a spin-off, if you will.
Well, there was, but what I was going to say was that the lyrics that I started to write were extremely personal and very in the moment, which is not a way that I'd particularly written in the past. And I think that that urgency has stayed with me in a lot of my writing since.
So when COVID hit, did you have to take precautions? I mean, what were the long-term effects of the illness?
Yes, no, it was extremely restrictive. I just released a solo album in 2020 called Storm Damage. I'd put together a new trio and I was about to go on tour. I then had to go into this isolation from the family. I had to use a different bathroom. I ate at different meal times.
You went into solitary, really?
I did. And I think, as I said right at the top of the show, you know, the playlist that I put together, Night Piano, was part of a series of playlists that I did partly to keep myself sane.
And this next piece?
Gonzalo Rubalcabas. He's an Afro-Cuban jazz pianist in his late 50s, one of the greats in terms of piano technique. I find in his work he has a real deep sense of reflection. And this piece I'm very drawn to, Silencio.
Silencio from Gonzalo Rubalcaba's 2006 album, Solo. And I want to talk to you about silence because it seems to me that it's a very undervalued commodity, especially in our world today.
Yes, I completely agree. I think understatement and leaving space is one of the key things you can do as a composer.
Or as a writer, or painter,
yes.
Or even a gardener.
Yeah, very true. Yes, a gardener, definitely. I mean, certainly on the new record that I've just made with Tracy, it was something we realised, having not worked together for so long, was a common language that we both shared, that idea of understatement and space, using the most simple of arrangements and not to over-egg. And I think what that does is it leaves so much room within the sound picture. You almost are able then to invite the listener into the experience so that they can almost walk around in the reverbs.
You immersed yourself very much in electronic music.
I did, yes.
What is it about that you found so exciting?
It was definitely a new language to explore. There's a great phrase that the writer Simon Reynolds uses about this next artist, where the music is both dystopian and luminous.
That's very good.
It really captures a lot of what I feel about electronic music. And Laurie Spiegel, who we're going to listen to in a moment, she said, "I automate whatever can be automated to be freer to focus on those aspects of music that can't be automated." I realised that's exactly how I felt about things, that there was nothing to be ashamed of, to use drum machines, to use programming, because it does, on the one hand, bring this kind of dystopian, luminous quality to music, but it also leaves room for all the stuff that you can't automate, like the human voice, like the backing vocals, like a guitar part. But this particular piece of Laurie Spiegel's, there was a reissued 1980 album of hers called The Expanding Universe, and this track appears on it. And it was basically made on a system of microcomputers and modular synthesizers, and the system was called Groove, which stood for Generated Real-Time Operations on Voltage-Controlled Equipment, which I think is just brilliant in itself.
I mean, nowadays you can virtually make a disc with a smartphone, but she had great banks of stuff.
Well, I mean, you had to. The actual size of equipment in those days, you know, disk drives were the size of washing machines, and nothing had any memory in it. And it was extremely expensive to use this equipment. If you were interested in electronic music at the time, you often had to go to somewhere that maybe had a Buchla synthesizer and just rent the room for an hour to be able to use it. And because there was no memory, you couldn't capture your recordings the way you can now on a laptop. You just basically had to commit it to tape. It is so simple, and the thing that really grabs me is the use of repetition, but with microtonal changes, which is, of course, a big part of electronic music and goes back to the work of Steve Reich and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, we should explain that a microtonal interval is one that is smaller than a semitone.
Yeah.
So just little degrees one way or the other.
And a lot of it comes from the voltage destabilization of the equipment that's being used.
Laurie Spiegel's The Unquestioned Answer from her 1980 album, The Expanding Universe. As we said, you and Tracy Thorn were musical partners in Everything But the Girl, and of course became life partners too. What's it like to share a working life with her?
Well, I think what's happened, certainly since the pandemic, is we've rediscovered each other's company. And of course, now the kids are grown up, they're in their 20s, and they've left home. And suddenly here we are looking at each other and actually really enjoying being around each other again, which I think has been one of the triggers that has made us record again.
And as well as returning to looking at each other, you've returned somewhat to your roots as a singer-songwriter on the guitar.
Well, that was just prior to this period, yes. I realised I wanted to sing again and I wanted to play guitar. I thought I was going to be really excited again to play it again, having been a DJ for such a long time. But I found I was incredibly bored with all the voicings and familiar handshapes that I was putting on the fretboard. So I started to investigate altered tunings and open tunings.
Explain for people who may not know what you mean by open tuning.
So the six strings on the guitar are usually tuned E, A, D, G, B, E. But once you start twisting the pegs at the end of the guitar and changing the tuning of the individual strings, you end up with a completely different instrument. Joni Mitchell developed 50 tunings in her lifetime. And then I started to investigate other guitarists who'd worked in this area and came across this next person, Dean McPhee, who's from West Yorkshire. And I particularly love this piece of his from about 10 years ago. It's called Sky Burial.
Thank you. fascinating use of the metallic as well as the sort of lyrical qualities of the guitar.
Yes, I mean, he plays on a Fender Telecaster through an amp, and there's definitely that sound of the strings rattling on the keyboard when he plays, which I really like.
Dean McPhee's Sky Burial from his 2010 album Brown Bear. Let's just go back to your book, Romany and Tom, documenting your parents' deteriorating health. It must have been a very difficult time, and you beautifully explore the losses of old age, memory, places, and it coincided with your own sort of breakdown, really, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was a very difficult period. I went into quite a dark place for a while.
There's a very moving passage when you arrive at the care home where they're living and burst into tears, because your dad simply says, "I know, I know."
Yeah. No, it was tough. I was living in London and they were in a care home outside of Bristol, and I'd made one aborted attempt to drive out to see them and had been so sort of consumed with jet lag and tiredness and general depression that I just circled a roundabout just off the M4 and ended up going home because I couldn't bring myself to do the drive. And then when I finally did go out to see them a couple of days later, my dad was in a particularly bad way, confined to a bed. My mother was in despair because everything was kind of unravelling. And I sat down with my father on the edge of his bed in the semi-darkness, and he just put his arms around me and said those words. And it was very, very, very moving.
Didn't need to say more.
No.
And that's true of what we've been talking about in music very often.
Yes, simplicity and silence.
Mm. The next piece is by the Latvian composer, Petteris Vasks. This is originally a choral piece.
It is originally a choral piece. Songs of Love, the Signum Saxophone Quartet do this saxophone arrangement. I don't know, I find it sort of pastoral but also dissonant and, you know,
fractured.
Exactly. And as we've learned in this programme, these things really appeal to me.
Songs of Love 4, and the track called Then Time Stopped by Petteris Vasks, performed by the Signum Saxophone Quartet. In addition to making music and writing, Ben Watt, you're also passionate about the natural world.
Yes, well, that's something that I think probably goes back to my mother and my grandfather. My grandfather was one of the first naturalist radio broadcasters and was a bit of a hero on the BBC in the 1930s and 40s, and had a series of nature programmes that were basically him in the countryside with two schoolgirls and a dog. And it was almost like a sort of latter-day David Attenborough or David Bellamy. 13 million people tuned into his show, which is like a soap opera these days. But he passed that on to my mother, and she enrolled me in the RSPB when I was a child. And during lockdown, I visited one of my local birding places, which is Brent Reservoir in northwest London. It is a famous SSSI, one of the major London green spaces, but it has been suffering appalling neglect. And I just felt a desire to do something about it. You know, there were wheelie bins on the marshes and supermarket trolleys and old car bumpers. And I just thought, how has this been allowed to happen? We formed a pressure group and have spent the last 2 years trying to do something about it.
Your next track is by Sam Gendel.
Yes, Sam Gendel is an American young saxophonist and electronic explorer, sort of conceptual, but free-flowing. And he's absolutely prolific. His first album had 53 tracks on it, and I think he's a real inspiration.
Mouthfeel 5 from Sam Gendel and Josiah Steinbrick's 2021 album, Mouthfeel Serene. Well, that brings us to the end, Ben Watt, and I must thank you for taking us into somewhat foreign waters from our usual classical choices. It's very refreshing to explore crossover ideas like silence and things like that. And even with Kathleen Ferrier, you managed not to have Blow the Wind southerly. So it only remains for me to thank you very much, Ben Watt.
Thank you.
Ben Watt. The programme was produced by Claire Walker and presented by me, Michael Barclay. And you can find details of all today's music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds, where you can also download hundreds of previous editions.
Hello, I'm Neo, and I am so pleased to be back for Series 2 of the Music and Meditation podcast.
When I'm lying down, my eyes are closed and my hands on my heart. That's kind of who I am.
I feel like I could speak to you all day.
It's always a good sign.
If you're curious about meditation and how it can help you, then this is the podcast for you.
Allow your body to relax.
Notice your breath in this moment.
Tune into my series, the Music and Meditation podcast on BBC Sounds. Hit subscribe now to get new episodes as soon as they're released. Imagine if you just listened to that every single day, every morning. There's no way your life couldn't change.
Yeah, of course.